Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, welcome. My first guest today has been called the smiling face of conscientious eating, righteous but never self-righteous. Her book has been described as a searing account of an industry gone awry and one woman's passionate fight to remedy it. Coming later in today's show, renowned chef Mark Reinfeld. Mark's Vegan Fusion World Cuisine won 9 international awards, and he's now come up with more than 175 quick, delicious, healthy recipes for everyday cooking. And vegan cooking has never appealed to me, but I'm telling you, some of the recipes in his book look really good. That's coming up around 12:40 today. But first, I'm very, very pleased to welcome Nicolette Hahn-Niemann. She's an environmental activist who's been published in the New York Times and spoken at numerous national conferences, including the American Public Health Association Annual Conference and the Sierra Club's Healthy Farms Conference. She was the former senior attorney with Bobby Kennedy's Waterkeeper Alliance and is now married to the founder of Niemann Ranch, a collective of traditional farms and ranches. Her new book is called Righteous Pork Chop, Finding a Life and Good Food Beyond Factory Farms. Nicolette, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm really pleased to have you here because this has been on my mind about doing a show about this very subject for quite a while. And it was just a question of finding the right guest who's had firsthand experience and seen both sides of the fence, so to speak.
Yeah.
Yeah. So your book is categorized. Let's just talk about that for a moment. It's categorized as part memoir, part expose. You've been quoted as saying you wrote it for those who believe in sound environmental practices and those who care about animals but are not making the connection with the food they eat. Tell us a little bit more about your book in your own words.
Sure. Well, I was hired by Bobby Kennedy Jr. to be an environmental attorney in the year 2000. And he asked me to work full-time on the issue of livestock production. And I didn't really know anything about the issue when he first asked me to do that. And as I learned more and more about it and sort of all of the problem with industrialized animal production, I was shocked that I had been in, you know, so much ignorance about it. And over the last 8 years now, that was, you know, actually 9 years ago, I've continued to work on this issue, and I'm continually encountering people that are very well educated, are really informed about a lot of things, but really don't know much about how their food is produced, and especially how their animal foods, their dairy products, their eggs, and their meat are produced. And because I believe the system is so, messed up, basically,
right, right.
I really felt that someone needed to try to write a book that would connect with those people who, you know, who want to read something readable and engaging, who aren't going to necessarily read a technical, dry, boring book, but want to read a story and maybe kind of an adventure book. And that's kind of what this book is. And yet it takes you through all the sectors of the meat industry and the dairy industry so that people really come to understand how most animal products are produced today.
Mm. Now, before Robert F. Kennedy hired you, you were a lawyer for the National Wildlife Federation.
Right.
You then, as you said, became the senior attorney for the environmental group Waterkeeper, which was headed by Robert F. Kennedy. And he assigns this very sexy assignment to you. You are a longtime vegetarian, and he asks you to go and head up the hog campaign, which you describe in your own words as an immersion in poop.
Right.
tell us what that was like.
I didn't know very much about the issue, but I knew enough to know that that meant my main preoccupation would be manure. And I was, a little hesitant to take that on because sort of working full time on manure just sounded quite bleak. But he suggested that in order to better understand the issue, I should go and visit with some of the people that were affected by this. And so initially he sent me to Missouri, and then he sent me to North Carolina. And what I found in both communities was citizens that were, in many cases, farmers themselves, and they were their whole lives had been turned upside down by the arrival of these big agribusiness hog operations. And the reason for that was because the operations caused so much pollution that local waterways and groundwater were contaminated, and so much odor that people were continually forced to keep their windows shut in the middle of summertime. They could no longer sit on their front porches or hang their laundry outside. And to meet people and see, in many cases, I was visiting farms that where the family had been there for several generations, and all of a sudden they were living essentially in an unlivable place, even though, you know, they had been there for generations and this agribusiness company had just come in and set itself up next door or nearby. And I was so shocked that this was happening in the United States, you know, where I always thought property rights were important. And if someone was, you know, making your own house a place that was unlivable, you know, that would be illegal. And just to see what was happening out in the rural areas where these operations exist was very shocking to me. And I became very interested in working on it because I wanted to help the people, and I also wanted to help the animals who were living in these very bleak circumstances.
Yes, and this is such a huge huge thing for you, really, because the agricultural business is, and factory farming in general, is so huge. Where did you start? How did you start to try and make a difference in this?
Well, we were all lawyers. The organization I work for, Bobby Kennedy Jr., is an environmental lawyer, and I was an environmental lawyer working for him. And Rick Dove, my colleague down in North Carolina, is also a lawyer. And so what we wanted to do was to use the law to sort of rein in the abuses of these operations. And what was most intriguing was that we believed, and the theory of what we were doing was, that they were actually violating the existing laws. So we didn't feel that we even needed to get the laws changed. We just needed to get the laws enforced.
And interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's something that people often don't appreciate, is the fact that you know, the laws are pretty much on the books for most environmental protections, and especially in this arena. But the problem is when you have, you know, the law is only as good as how much it's enforced. So if you have a very strong law, but there's no one on the state or federal level that has the willpower or the resources to enforce it, it's as good as having no law. But what's lucky is that the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act and some of the other federal environmental laws that we were using were they're enforceable by citizens. There's a provision in those laws that makes it possible to bring a lawsuit just as an ordinary person, as long as you can show that you are affected by the pollution. So what we were doing is we were talking with people in the communities that were directly affected by these polluting hog operations. And I should describe them a little bit, maybe. They're all sort of metal buildings with no windows. They contain generally a little bit over 1,000 pigs per building, and the pigs never leave that building, and they're standing on a hard surface with a slatted floor so that their manure and urine goes down into a pit beneath the building. So they're kind of continually standing in their own manure and in the vapors from the manure that's beneath them. And then it is periodically pumped out to these big holding ponds that are called lagoons. So they're very unpleasant places for workers and for the pigs, and they are a huge environmental problem because they contain, these holding ponds contain literally hundreds of millions of gallons of liquefied manure. And manure is not necessarily a bad thing. You know, we all know that we put it on our garden.
Mm-hmm.
But when it's in raw form, and it's especially when it's in the liquid form, because that allows all the pathogens to continue to exist, And so there's a lot of danger from the pathogens, as well as just the massive quantity of nitrogen and phosphorus that are contained in these. So when they do leak to groundwater or spill over into streams, they cause, sometimes huge fish kills and algae blooms that kill lots of, pretty much everything that's in the water gets killed eventually. And the odor is tremendous because you have these huge ponds of liquefied manure, and you get basically these clouds of hydrogen sulfide that come off of them. So what we were doing at Waterkeeper Alliance, and what I started there with Rick Dove, was to go through the records of the state agency and look at, on what occasions they had documented cases of pollution, and also to look through the files of all the citizen complaints, and to talk with citizens in the community and do our own water sampling as well, and then to build cases against those entities that were especially egregious in terms of their environmental impact. And we started filing lawsuits in federal court down there in North Carolina. So that was our first strategy, was using the law.
Right. And as you said, many people don't realize those laws are already on the books because it's not being enforced. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Nicolette Hahn-Niemann. Her book is called Righteous Pork Chop, and there is hope. Nicolette has some good tips for us about finding meat that is good and dairy that's good for us. Stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Do you have legal questions? Need to know where to turn?
Hi, this is Rick Gregrick, your host of Northwest Legal Compass.
Northwest Legal Compass will address your questions on a variety of legal topics, including estate planning, asset protection, real estate and business planning, and more. The legal and accounting staff of Gregrick and Associates are dedicated to providing you with superior legal and tax services. Their integrated counsel is geared to the achievement of your goals.
Visit us on the web at rjglegal.com.
Be sure and tune in every Friday at noon here on Alternative Talk 1150. If you missed a show on Conversations Live, check out conversationslive.net for dozens of free podcasts. Topics range from health and healing to business and career growth, from personal development to creativity, adventure, and the challenges of the human spirit. See conversationslive.net for talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. conversationslive.net, making a difference one word at a time.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, talk radio to help you live well, live strong.
Notice anything different? You should. There's no other station like Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And I need to correct myself. My guest's name is Nicolette Hahn-Niemann. I kept saying Niemann, and it's actually Hahn-Niemann. Her new book is called Righteous Pork Chop, Finding a Life and Good Food Beyond Factory Farms. Now, before the break, Nicolette, you were sharing with us a little glimpse into factory farming. I've been to several environmental filmmakers festivals, and when I first went the first one that I went to, and I started seeing films about factory farming, I honestly didn't believe it.
Yeah.
I truly did not believe that we allowed this to happen in, you know, a civilized country.
Yep. I had exactly the same reaction. Mm-hmm. In fact, my first thought when I started to talk to people in rural communities that were describing this and describing their lives, and I kind of thought they were, you know, sort of grossly exaggerating it in order to, you know, get our attention or to get our help. And then when I started, you know, seeing it for myself and talking to people all over the country who did not know each other and had never talked to each other, and they were describing exactly the same thing. For example, one of the things that I heard from many people all over the country was that if they live near one of these hog or dairy operations, because we can talk about dairy too, I'd love to, are kind of similar operations with very concentrated and with huge liquefied manure ponds. And people that live near these operations would tell me that on days when the smell was really bad, that either they or someone else in their family had actually vomited as a result of the odor. And the first time someone told me that, I thought, well, maybe they were already sick or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then I kept hearing this, and I heard it several times from people who had spent their life farming, and in many cases farming, doing livestock farming. And so it, you know, reinforced to me, you know, the thing that one farmer I remember said to me, you know, we're used to farming odors. These are not farming odors. These are something totally different and new. And that was, that really, you know, struck me. This method of raising animals was unlike anything that had been done in the past as far as animal farming. And certainly in terms of environmental impact, the potential and the actual environmental impact, as well as the odor and just sort of the quality of life effects that it has on people in the community. Because farmers had historically been good neighbors in rural communities. People liked living near other, you know, properties that were farmed.
Right, right.
But these operations had, you know, they affected the lives so much of people living in their homes that in many cases people would literally sell their homes, even if they had to accept a much lower than, you know, asking price than what they, you know, what it should have been worth. And I talked to several people that did that. I also met people who tried to sell their homes and were unable to because of the proximity to these operations. And so, you know, as you said, Vicki, it was something that when I was hearing about this initially, I couldn't believe it. I thought it couldn't quite be as bad as it was being described. But the more I learned, the more I realized it was true. We are, in fact, doing this on a national level. And we're raising our animals in this industrial way, but we're doing it kind of out of the sight of most people, and especially most urban people who aren't out in these rural areas very much. And so, you know, we can get our food in the grocery store or the restaurant, and we don't make the connection. We don't even, in many cases, we really have no idea that that's how it's being done.
Yeah, let's talk a little about, I do want to get to how we choose, you know, we have options here. We have really positive options here, and we're going to get to those in a minute. But I just want to talk a little bit about cattle and dairy, as you mentioned. But before we get to that, let's talk about the crates that pregnant pigs are kept in.
Yeah, this is an interesting issue because, you know, this is kind of among people who are kind of working and reforming industrial farming. I think there's a pretty strong consensus that this is one of the most troubling practices. And it's actually been already banned in the European Union because it's kind of been recognized that it really should never have been started in the first place. And in the United States, this is a practice that has been outlawed in several states by citizen initiative. And what it is, you know, people are often aware that veal calves are put into crates. And this is still a practice that is quite widespread.
Right, right.
But what they don't know is that also the female pigs, the breeding pigs, are put into a similar kind of crate, except for that it's made out of metal. And the crate is so small, generally. It's less than 2 feet wide. And so she is, it's so narrow, and it's about 5 feet long. And this is an animal that might weigh as much as 700 pounds. They're usually in the 500 to 700-pound range. And so they are literally rubbing up against the bars 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
Now, they're kept that way because the industry, you know, it's much more manageable. It's easier. You can have a lot more animals in one space if you do it that way. You don't have to, essentially, you don't have to provide them any care. You're basically just warehousing them. Their feed and water is automated, and they're just essentially immobilized.
Mm.
And they're kept that way throughout their pregnancies, and then they are put in a slightly larger crate once they give birth, but it's a similar kind of structure. And then they are, after they give birth and they're their piglets are weaned after a couple of weeks, they're re-impregnated, and they go back into that smaller box. So they're spending almost their entire adult lives in these metal, very small metal cages. And I witnessed several of these operations myself. I walked through them, I looked at the pigs, and it was quite, it was probably one of the most shocking things I experienced, because I was already aware that pigs have an intelligence that's comparable to dogs. And if we think of a dog being kept in that kind of confinement, you know, 24 hours a day, that would just never be tolerated in this society.
Right.
And to see pigs that way, they were so obviously in great distress. I mean, they actually exhibit behaviors, and I witnessed this myself as well, but I've also read about it. It's a widespread thing. They exhibit behaviors that are associated with humans that are insane. So they do things like they're waving their heads, and they do this what they call sham chewing. They're continually chewing in the air. They're kind of exhibiting behaviors that are, you know, signs of extreme neuroses. And, you know, it's logical, because they're being put into a condition that would make any creature go insane.
It's like being straitjacketed permanently all of your life, really.
Exactly.
They literally cannot move. Many of them have their tails cut off, I know, without anesthetic. And then in addition to that, you point out, you know, in addition to them not being able to move, and even if they're not in the cage, they're still in very, very confined quarters.
Right.
So in addition to them not being able to move, the toxic fumes, that you've got bacteria, yeast, molds have been recorded there because of the close proximity of them all.
Right. All of the pigs, regardless of their gender or their age, are kept in very tight conditions, and they're kept continually inside and on a hard surface. So there's no soft bedding for them to lie down in. You know, we think of farm animals lying in straw, and they should be. But these operations do not have any kind of bedding for the animals. And they're, you know, as you mentioned, there's the air and the environment they're standing in is really a filthy environment. So they're continually breathing pathogens and things like ammonia and hydrogen sulfide. And for that reason, they're also very prone to lots of diseases. And that has led to the practice of continually feeding them drugs to keep them alive. And so I document in my book, Righteous Pork Chop, that over 90% of hog operations are estimated to continually feed antibiotics to the pigs just to keep them alive.
And then this stuff, of course, because their manure is leaking, it goes into the holding pond, which then leaks into the rivers, which kids, you know, I've seen environmental films where kids are literally cannot swim in their local lakes and pools and rivers anymore because
Absolutely.
Of the pollution.
That's right. There, in fact, one of the things that Rick Dove, my colleague down in North Carolina, spent a lot of time, you know, working with, is the state began posting, closures all over. They're closing all the beaches and the waterfronts along the lakes because there was such high level of contamination, which was directly traceable to the confinement poultry and hog operation.
Mm. I want to look at a couple more issues, and then I want to look at some good news.
Yes, it's important to talk about the good news.
Yeah, but I also think it's equally important to look at this so that we really know what's happening and make a choice whether we're going to participate in this, you know, when we spend our dollars or not.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about beef. You call it the most unfairly maligned of meats. And
yes.
This shocked me. The cattle branding, which we all know, they usually get a big old hot iron on their butt or their shoulder. But now slaughterhouses are encouraging farms to brand cows on the face so it doesn't ruin the hide.
Yeah, that's something. It's not a widespread practice, it's something that is sort of, and I think there's been enough reaction against it that I don't know if it ever will become a major concern. But there is some of this happening, and that's because when beef cattle are slaughtered, some of the value of each individual animal is the hide. And so the hot iron branding, which has been traditionally used in the beef cattle industry, actually damages the hide. And so slaughterhouses are now encouraging that branding take place on the face. And I've seen cattle that this has been done to, and it's very troubling. And this is something that Bill and I both oppose very strongly. My husband, Bill, and I both oppose very strongly, and we have spoken out against it in a number of situations, and we certainly would never do that or encourage that in any way. But I think that it is not something that necessarily will become widespread, because I've spoken with cattle ranchers about it, and I have not encountered any enthusiasm for the idea at all.
I'm glad to hear that. I'm very glad to hear that.
Yeah.
Three major areas of legitimate concern about modern beef production, you say, are inappropriate cattle feeding, drug abuse, and concentration of too many cattle in certain locations. So same kind of thing that we're seeing with hogs.
Right. The difference is, and the reason why I say that I think beef cattle, you know, they have much better lives than other animals in the other sectors. And so they kind of, you know, it's kind of the sector that is the least industrialized. And the concerns that I identify in the book are very real concerns, however. And those are, as you said, concentration and what's fed and, you know, the possibility of odor and pollution. So generally, the real problems come from the feedlots, and especially the really big feedlots. And, you know, people in different parts of the country are familiar generally with one, you know, feedlot that's somewhere near a highway or something. In California, people often talk about a feedlot on Highway 5, and which has, you know, around 100,000 animals in it in a fairly small area. So there's tremendous opportunity for pollution and odor and flies. Flies are another big problem associated with cattle feedlots. And the feeding of cattle as well as other animals, it's not just the cattle feeding, but certainly cattle feeding is problematic because the drugs are used very commonly, and it's still legal to feed certain animal byproducts to cattle, although they really are supposed to be herbivores.
Mm. Amazing. Let's look at dairies. You say that the truth about dairies made you blush. And I have to admit, I found some of this information out about a year ago when I was at a workshop, and it shocked me too.
Yeah, well, it made me blush because I'm a vegetarian, and I have been for a long time. And so I thought, well, I'm not eating meat, you know, so I'm not giving my money to these kinds of factory farms. And what I learned as I worked at Waterkeeper Alliance and in the years subsequent as well is that the egg industry and the dairy industry are at least as problematic, and in my view, actually probably the most problematic sectors of all. And, you know, one thing that's really important for vegetarians to keep in mind is that all animals in the food system, whether they're producing eggs or dairy, eventually are slaughtered for food. And so it's, you know, it is true that you're still participating in, you know, in animal foods for humans that are animals that are being slaughtered essentially. But I think more importantly, the point that I wanted to make is, you know, I wasn't going to give up my dairy and my eggs, and so I needed to really look at the conditions of the way dairy and eggs are produced and make sure I was comfortable with those conditions of the foods I was buying, and I was not comfortable at all because dairy cows are, you know, the modern dairies, the big modern dairies, which are now in the Northwest a lot, where you guys are.
Right, right.
And as well as in California, where I'm located, this is what the dairy industry looks like now. And these are dairies that have thousands of cows in them, sometimes as many as 10,000 cows. And when you think about a traditional dairy that took, you know, that was in mostly in the upper Midwest, in Wisconsin and Minnesota and in the upper parts of New York State and such, those dairies tended to have around 50 cows. That was the traditional size of a dairy until about 1950. So that's an enormous leap to go up to thousands of dairy mm-hmm. cows, and especially a 10,000 cow dairy is huge, and it produces a huge amount of waste. But in order to have that many animals, again, they're pretty much continually confined. They may have, in some cases, they'll have an outdoor dry lot area that they can be on, but it's a very small area generally, and there's no grazing at all. So they're never doing the thing that they're intended to do, which is to graze.
Yeah.
And So the more I learned about the dairy industry, the more I found it very troubling. And the way that, and the disposition of the calves is probably the biggest problem. They're immediately taken. In order for a dairy cow to produce milk, she has to have a calf regularly. It's called freshening. And in order, for that happens regularly in the dairy industry. Every dairy cow regularly has a calf. That calf is, however, only valuable if it's a female. Now, if it's a female, it's taken away from the mother right at birth, and it's put in a little hut, generally, and raised it that way. So it's not a very pretty existence. But it's even worse if it's a male calf, mm-hmm. because that is an animal that has essentially no value in the dairy industry. And so those become the veal that is available in the United States, generally. There are other things that can happen as well. But for someone who is buying dairy products should also familiarize themselves with the veal industry as well, because it's all part of the story.
Yeah, I mean, for years I haven't eaten veal, from choice, and I did not realize until last year that by buying milk, I was participating in the veal industry.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And then I keep jumping ahead to the part about the consumer products that you want to talk about, but it is possible to buy from places that have whose calves end up in a better place.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that, because I should say, you finally had enough of this. You were losing your hair. The job was just creating an inordinate amount of stress for you. You have a new boss come in that you just knew things weren't going to work out. So you quit.
Right.
And you ended up, after you'd quit, after you'd done all this research and after you quit, one of the ranchers who does natural ranching got in touch with you, and you guys are now married. That's part of the story you share in the book. But I want you to talk about some of the natural options that we have to us.
Yeah. Well, when I was working for Waterkeeper as a senior attorney, I felt it's really important that we have models of good animal husbandry, because the industry, the dairy and the meat industry, was responding to our work and our advocacy by saying, well, these are, New York lawyers that are, trying to wipe out the meat industry or the dairy industry, and they don't understand anything about agriculture. And I felt that the best response to that would be if we would be able to present real-world examples of a different way, a better way. And so we got involved with lots of very good farms and ranches and organizations of farmers and ranchers. And the main one that we became connected with was Nyman Ranch, and which was based here in California. And it's really a network of traditional farmers and ranchers. And the founder of that network is Bill Nyman, who I then married, and then I moved out to California after we got married and actually became involved in ranching myself. So for the past 6 years, I've worked on our own ranch, and I've also worked very closely with other farms and ranches that are doing things in the non-industrial way, in the traditional way, where people are really working with animals and where animals are given good lives and they live outdoors on grass. And what I discovered and what, kind of really was reinforced to me by that whole experience is that it is very possible to raise animals in a way that gives them a good life. And if the slaughter is done properly, their lives can be taken in a way that they don't know fear or pain. And really, it offers opportunity to have meat and dairy products, without any of the horrendous situations that happen in factory farms.
Right. And Bill Nyman, your now husband, has been called the godfather of meat, the guru of happy cows,
yes.
a pioneer of the good meat movement, the Steve Jobs of meat. I know you both very actively work to ensure good food and safe, humane, sustainable conditions.
Right.
Where do I buy my meat if I choose to go the better way?
Well,
in
one
my
of the
opinion.
Things I encourage in Righteous Pork Chop is that people try to explore sort of alternative venues, because one of the things that has been clear to me, if you go into a large sort of standard supermarket, there's very little there that really meets the conditions that I think animals should be raised in. Even if it says organic, organic dairy and meat is better than just straight commodity foods. But it isn't necessarily the best. And what I encourage people to do is to try to go to some of the places that might work directly with traditional farms. And the best place, really, is the farmer's market, generally. So there you can talk directly to the family that raises the food, generally. Almost every farmer market I've ever been to, and I've been to a lot of them around the country, the farmers themselves are selling the products directly. And so you can ask questions. In many cases, they have pictures of the farm. And you can get meat and dairy products, cheeses, fresh milk, eggs, right at those stands and directly from the farmer who raised it. It's kind of the best possible thing. Another alternative to get directly from farms is the so-called CSAs, Community Supported Agriculture, where you kind of sign up to get a portion of a farm production every year. And that was, up until just a few years ago, that was only being done with vegetables and some fruits a little bit. But more and more now, there are dairy and meat and eggs available through CSAs. So that's another great way to get food and really know where it comes from and how it was raised. I also recommend people shop at co-ops because my experience has been that co-ops tend to know a lot about where their food comes from, and most of them want to work directly with local farmers as well that are raising their animals traditionally. So I think places, the co-ops are great places to shop generally, and also smaller independently owned grocery stores. We have a great one here in San Francisco called Buy Right Market, which my husband Bill has been working with for many, many years. And they literally know where every single fruit and every single piece of meat comes from and the farm that it comes from. And they have visited personally, the owners of that store have personally visited the farms of most of the places where they buy from. So it's kind of like they're doing the work for you. But I think it's, you know, people think of it, maybe it's too much of a chore to go and research all their food. But the truth is, once you start down this path, it's actually a lot of fun. You enjoy the process of discovering and tasting things from these different places and learning where it's from. And I know Bill and I have gotten a lot of our friends and family really invigorated to do this kind of thing. And they report back to us all the time about the things that they're discovering. And they really enjoy the process of learning how to improve what they're eating.
And what about if I'm eating out, Nicolette? What kind of questions should I ask there before I decide if I want to eat there?
Yeah, I think it's important to think about restaurants, too. You know, our experience has been that generally a restaurant, a chef or an owner, tends to be committed to doing this or they're not. And so we try to seek out those restaurants where the chef really cares about their ingredients. And, in fact, I'm on the board of a national group called Chefs Collaborative, which is a network of chefs that are all trying to do things in a sustainable way. And those kinds of restaurants tend to know where their food comes from. And so one of the things we always do is we ask, a lot of times we ask before we even sit down, if it's in a place we're not familiar with, we'll ask about where they get their meat from. And if they don't know the answer, a lot of times we end up choosing not to eat there. And if we're already seated, you know, we ask the questions and then we order accordingly. And, you know, my husband Bill, of course, is a meat eater, and he always asks where the meat comes from. And if the server doesn't know the answer, we always encourage them to go and ask the chef. And if the chef doesn't know where the meat comes from, you know, my husband does not order it. And he ends up usually eating a pasta primavera or something like that. So
right.
he just goes vegetarian for that night. Because
right.
We both really believe in the importance of knowing where our food comes from.
Yeah, and I think, you know, after hearing some of the stories, reading more in your book, that's good advice for us all. Very quickly, what would you like to leave our listeners with today?
Well, I just think that, you know, it becomes overwhelming sometimes thinking about all of what's wrong with meat and dairy and egg production. And I think sometimes people think, well, I just can't do anything about it. There's too much wrong, and it's too hard to get to the good stuff, and there isn't enough of it out there. And I encourage people, you know, baby steps are okay. Just start trying to make some changes in your diet where you can. Take the opportunities to explore some other places where you can, you know, buy, like at the farmer's market and co-ops, where you can buy things from traditional farms. And you will begin to discover that the food tastes better, you feel better about what you're eating, and it just enhances the whole process of cooking and eating food.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you being with us today. Fantastic book. I really think anybody who's at all concerned about being a participant in factory food farming, which we are if we buy those products. I'd highly recommend this book. It's called Righteous Pork Chop, Finding a Life and Good Food Beyond Factory Farms. Nicolette Hahn-Nyman, thank you so much for being with us today.
And thank you, Vicki.
Tell us where our listeners can find out more about you.
I have a website called righteousporkchop.com, and I'm also on Facebook, and I invite listeners to join my Facebook page, which is Nicolette Hahn-Nyman, and anyone who wants to be a member of my Facebook page is more than welcome.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Keep up the good
You're
work.
Welcome.
You're doing great
Thank
things.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And please stay with us. We'll be right back. We're trying to get hold of Mark Reinfeld right now. He's a vegan chef. He's more than just a vegan chef, but his vegan fusion world food has won 9 international awards, and hopefully we'll have him with us when we come back.
Coming next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, Deborah Gwartney had been a Newsweek correspondent for 10 years and was a reporter at The Oregonian when her daughters suddenly became the story. They ran away to live on the streets and then they vanished. Deborah shares her true story of a mother's frantic effort to recover her two beautiful daughters from harm's way. Later in the hour, we'll hear from Vanity Fair's editor Mark Seal. He'll share the true story of Oscar-nominated wildlife filmmaker Joan Root and her extraordinary life and untimely death in Africa. See conversationslive.net for more details.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicki St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicki asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
Commune with the Pop Oracle on the Radio 8 Ball Show. I'm Andras Jones, the host of the Radio 8 Ball Show, where we answer your questions by picking songs at random and interpreting them as the answers, like picking musical tarot cards. That's The Radio 8 Ball Show on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Don't miss The Radio 8 Ball Show now at its new time, Wednesdays at noon, here on Alternative Talk, 1150. If you like to read fiction, check out Book Talk Podcast Reviews, brought to you weekly by Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Go to conversationslive.net and click on the menu at Book Talk to hear reviews of an eclectic range of books. We review fiction from chick lit and mystery to suspense and literary, from new to old, overlooked and forgotten. Check out Book Talk Podcast today at conversationslive.net. If you'd like to suggest a book for review, email info@conversationslive.net or call 206-414-6159.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to help you heal and stay healthy.
Do you have legal questions? Need to know where to turn?
Hi, this is Rick Gregrick, your host of Northwest Legal Compass.
Northwest Legal Compass will address your questions on a variety of legal topics, including estate planning, asset protection, real estate and business planning, and more. The legal and accounting staff of Gregrick and Associates are dedicated to providing you with superior legal and tax services. Their integrated counsel is geared to the achievement of your goals.
Visit us on the web at rjglegal.com.
Be sure and tune in every Friday at noon here on Alternative Talk 1150.
You're listening to the refreshingly different Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
And welcome back, welcome back. We are now talking with Mark Reinfeld. He's the founding chef of the celebrated Blossoming Lotus restaurant. He's been preparing inspired vegan and live food cuisine for more than 15 years. And as I mentioned earlier in the show, his vegan fusion world cuisine has won 9 international awards, including a Gourmand Award for Best Vegetarian Cookbook in the USA. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Vicky. It's great to be here.
And we're talking today. I have the 30-minute vegan book in my hand, over 175 quick, delicious, and healthy recipes for everyday cooking. I said earlier at the start of the show that vegan cooking always seemed very restrictive to me, very unappealing until I saw your book.
Oh, great. Yeah, well, there's a whole exciting world awaiting you once you start trying the recipes.
And you wrote this for busy vegans in particular, but, I mean, anybody could enjoy these meals. Tell us about the book. Tell us a little bit about the book.
Well, it's really designed for anyone who's busy that's looking to include some healthy food into their life. And even if it's once a week or one meal a week, we provide these simple and award-winning recipes that people can follow in their own home and create amazing results.
Yeah. What struck me in vegan recipes that I've seen before, and maybe I haven't looked deeply enough because I know things change rapidly, but it seemed to be mostly uncolorful food, apart from, you know, fruits and vegetables. But in this book, there's a lot of color, there's a lot of texture, flavor. You've made vegan food fun. One of the things one of your recipes is Kiss Me at the Movies Cinnamon Sugar Popcorn, for example.
Yes. That's my wife and I co-created the book, and she infused her sense of humor throughout it as well.
Yeah, and it works. And your wife, Jennifer Murray, is the co-author of The Complete Idiot's Guide to Eating Raw, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So we're a husband and wife chef author team.
There you go. Now, I read in the book that you do plan all these elaborate meals and you write these elaborate cookbooks. At home, you eat very simply. You don't try and impress each other.
Yeah, the fun is the creation process of just creating the recipe that's going to, like you said, have the flavor and the color and the texture, something that really appeals to everyone.
Yeah, that's true. You've got everything in here from snacks, pick-me-ups and kids' favorites to breakfast and brunch, uplifting lunches, and even guilt-free comfort food.
Yeah, I think we covered all of our bases in this one, and it's really a great book for people that just want to eat a little healthier, whether it's to have a vegan meal once a week or once every couple of weeks, whatever. People feel like it's a great resource for them.
Right. Well, we talked in the first segment about factory farming and some alternative options to finding meat there. But why for you? Why vegan?
Well, that's a great question, and it has a lot of different elements to it. People choose it for different reasons, and if you ask them, most people will say for your health, and pretty much all national and international health organizations recommend eating more fruits and vegetables as a way to prevent disease, and a lot of people have success healing themselves by changing their food and their diet. So health reasons is one. Environmental reasons is another. A lot of people, the green movement is very strong, and everyone's concerned about going green. And really, if we look at how we eat and how we raise food, including vegan foods, is really as green as you could get as far as the least amount of impact on the environment in terms of water and land usage. And there was a UN report that said that 18% of all greenhouse gases come from the livestock industry.
Right.
So it's huge. It's more than all of the transportation industry. So if you think of switching your car to go more green, even just switching some of your meals is really equally effective.
Yeah.
And then some people, it's a moral issue and just feel like nonviolence. There's a lot of, some people could see a lot of violence in the world and want to know how to create a more peaceful, nonviolent world.
Well, I want to ask you about that because you have some heavy hitters who've reviewed this book. You, Deepak Chopra said, "I heartily recommend Vegan Fusion World Cuisine," which is your website and the work you do from that, for anyone seeking a healthier, inspired, and more peaceful life. Tell us how eating Vegan Fusion World Cuisine translates to a more inspired and peaceful life.
Well, let's look at when we come to a path and we can go to the left or the right, we could say, I want to take the more peaceful path in any situation, whether it's a confrontation or whatever it may be. And so when it comes to your table, if you say, I want to take a more peaceful path, then you start to look at where your food comes from. And so if one option is the fruit and vegetables that you grew in your backyard, that's a certain, you know, energy. And then another, there's a lot of really atrocities go on in the production of meat and dairy, just to the animals, and also, like I mentioned earlier, the impact on the environment.
Right.
So every little bit, when we take that choice and that step to something that's more gentle or peaceful, whether it's our diet or our communications, whatever it may be, we're doing our part, I feel, in a great way.
Right. So if I want a healthier lifestyle, if I want to, you know, at least have, say, one or two meals a week that are vegan, what kind of staples should I keep in my pantry?
Well, your favorite vegetables and fruits is a good place to start. Most people have their favorites. And so look to include a variety of them and colorful ones. And then have that be one part of your meal. And that could be a big salad. It could be steaming up the vegetables. It could be a light stir fry. There's other ways, but that's just one. And some, and then think in terms of adding like a grain component. Which we like quinoa, which is a grain from South America that's high in protein, and it's really light and delicious.
Say that again. Well, I missed what it was you said that you like.
It's quinoa, Q-U-I-N-O-A.
Okay.
And we use it throughout our book because it's a grain that cooks in about 15 minutes, 15 to 20 minutes. So it's part of the whole 30-minute vegan concept where you can make a dish, and while you're making that dish, you could have a pot of quinoa cooking, and then you have your grain and your vegetable at the same time. And then experiment with, have some beans and nuts and seeds that you like around the house, and experiment with different kinds of pasta. There's brown rice pasta is really good. And then, you know, as far as the pantry, just I suggest going for a trip to your local health food store and just walk down the aisles and see what, you know, you're drawn to.
Right.
You could pick up a barbecue sauce and make very simple barbecue tofu cutlets or tempeh cutlets and have them on the grill. And there's just a tremendous variety to choose from, and you just choose your favorites and build over time.
It's certainly, some of the pictures in here just make my mouth water. And the desserts.
Desserts are actually really popular in vegan cuisine. They probably convert more people because the range is just incredible of richness and just chocolate, delicious desserts. People aren't even aware they're vegan.
Mm. Well, we're almost at the end of our segment, Mark.
Okay.
What would you like to let our listeners know about the work that you do?
They can visit our website, which is veganfusion.com, and we post regularly on Twitter, and we're on Facebook, and we blog regularly, and we also have a free newsletter where we send out recipes and information and current events. Living an inspired life is very much a part of what we strive for. And so the website is veganfusion.com, and people could email if there's any questions. I'm happy to answer any questions as well.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate you being with us today, and wish you good luck with your work. And this new book is called The 30-Minute Vegan, over 175 quick, delicious, and healthy recipes for everyday cooking. And
thank you so much, Vicky. It's been a pleasure.
Sure. My guest again, Mark Reinfeldt. He wrote this with Jennifer Murray, his wife, his website, veganfusion.com. Thank you for being with us today. Any comments or feedback on today's show, you know where to reach me, conversationslive.net. We'll be back next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Coming next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Deborah Gwartney had been a Newsweek correspondent for 10 years and was a reporter at The Oregonian when her daughters suddenly became the story. They ran away to live on the streets, and then they vanished. Deborah shares her true story of a mother's frantic effort to recover her two beautiful daughters from harm's way. Later in the hour, we'll hear from Vanity Fair's editor Mark Seal. He'll share the true story of Oscar-nominated wildlife filmmaker Joan Root and her extraordinary life and untimely death in Africa. See conversationslive.net for more details.